This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
Oh, here we are. We are coming to you in between those moments of closing arguments and then a jury coming back with their decision. That's where we sit as we do this episode today. We're going to be discussing where everything has landed in the Lindsey Clancy trial, from the prosecution to the defense. Bob Mata, supposedly going to be joining us here very shortly. We're patiently awaiting Mr. Mata. Bob! Bob! We're just going to keep shouting Bob until he shows up. Robin Drake is, of course, with me, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program.
Playing the role of defense attorney today.
And yes, I said, get out your Sharpie. And
that's why I got my Bob mustache right here.
Yeah, there we go. Bob, do a Bob stash. Have a Bob stash on when Bob's late. But here we are. We can certainly discuss where we think this has landed. The prosecution laid out their case. Lindsey Clancy's jury started deliberating today after 5 weeks of testimony and over 80 witnesses. Where does it go from here? We're going to start with the prosecution, although I know the order in which the closing arguments were made happened in the opposite direction. Yep. But let's start there. There was fire with Reddington, and we're going to get to Reddington.
Yep.
I feel that when we had the prosecution giving theirs, I wasn't quite feeling fire. I wasn't even quite really feeling like Bunsen burner. I was like, kind of like those hand warmers you put in your pocket. Like, that's the amount of heat I was feeling in terms of passion for what they were delivering. What's your take, Robin?
Yeah, and it's fun, Tony, because we were texting back and forth as we were both watching both closing by Reddington as well as in the prosecution. And for the audience that follows us from the beginning of this and always, you know, the majority of us on the show, we're leaning towards Lindsey's not being guilty by reason of insanity or criminally responsible because of the preponderance of what we saw from our optic and lens, but at the same time, being very open to everything we've seen, critically thinking through it. And we'll get to Reddington next, but I'm with you. It was a very lackluster on the emotional side, as I saw it from the prosecution standpoint. I thought it was it lacked conviction comparatively, and I think that's the key point on this one, because if you looked at the substance of what they were saying, and I was really trying hard to look at it the best I could, and that's why Bob, when he gets here, will be great, because he was in the courtroom for all of this.
It says he's on his way.
Good. So sitting there and listening to the content, I thought they delivered accurately from their context and point of view, highlighting their people about why they think she's guilty. And from there, I set up Bob. There's the Bob. Bob, I was channeling my inner Bob, man.
We're talking about the prosecution, how it landed. We're going to get to Reddington next, but we're going to start with the prosecution end of things. I had said, you know, Reddington came in, you know, with fire. I felt like the heat from the prosecution felt kind of like those hand warmers you get when you go to a game. It's like, they keep you a bit warm, but they certainly as hell aren't fire like Reddington. Bob, what was your just general take there, being in that courtroom with the closings from the prosecution first? We don't have Bob
sound,
audio. Bob.
Turn on your sound, Bob.
Sorry, I'm not an optimal setup, boy. So
that looks great. Look at you.
Starlink going. I'm sitting in the back of a Denali, and it is what it is.
Here we go.
You've only been there for 5 weeks, Bob. It's all right. Suck it up.
I was in the van down by the river.
Thank you, Bob. You're a rock star, man.
Man, I appreciate it. I'm ready to get home. Here's my honest take. And it was interesting because I spoke to a lot of people, a lot of the media that I'm sitting with, and I'm not obviously traditional media. So you know, I was asking, what was your take of the closings? And I was surprised. A lot of them felt that the Commonwealth's closing was good, that they may have moved the needle in some respects. I mean, my biggest issues were that they still didn't pick a theory. Like they start off,
yeah, I agree.
Beginning the closing, and Sprague's like, well, you know, okay, I know that we were telling you that we didn't think it was a real suicide, but we think it was a legitimate suicide, you know. And I'm like, but then towards the end, she flips it back, you know. And she's like, well, you know, she's a nurse; she would know, you know, how to cut. I'm like, what? Like, they just can't pick a theory. I don't know how that's affecting the jury. I don't know if the jury's been picking up on all these inconsistencies, you know, like, and she gets into the, you know, whether or not Pat said he had to untie the ligatures, right. You know, the exercise bands. And like, when that happened, like a million people clipped that scene from his testimony. And he definitely said, I had to untie them. And I had a problem with some of them. I'm like, why is she lying? You know, and it's like, but again, I'm biased. I make no bones about it. Sure. I am 100% believing that Lindsay was psychotic.
Sure.
I believe that she was disassociated from her body. I believe that she heard this voice and she was not in her right mind. Yeah. You know, so I'm like, and that's where I'm at. And I respect if people are like, I think she's full of it. It's everything the Commonwealth said, but that's not where I'm at. I think it was a very real thing for her. I think that she's in her own worst prison. So for me, I mean, it didn't move the needle at all in time. And, you know, even though going into it, I've basically 100% made up my mind of where I would vote if I were on the jury. You know, I still keep an open mind going into closings. Like maybe they're going to point out something. They're going to argue something that I didn't think of. Or put it in such a way where I'm like, huh, all right, well, that's interesting. And for me, that didn't happen, you know, with the prosecution.
Is that common to have a moving target like that, Bob? Because you're right. I was trying to figure out, because they were making points. And so there's two things in there. Is there any way you can actually object to when they actually lie in closing like that? And the second point is it typical for the prosecution or anyone on closing to, it's like she didn't have one scripted until she's actually watching a testimony. And I know you're building it throughout, but it's like from the start to the end, it became a moving target based on the testimony that her own people provided.
Yeah. I mean, Robin, that blew my mind. It blew my mind when the first expert Heilbrunn said, this was a very serious suicide attempt. And I'm like, holy shit. Like these women, like it's not as if they didn't have their expert reports and know that their experts were going to get on the stand,
right?
Because they need it for their motive theory. These both of those experts need it. Their theory being that Lindsay was going to kill herself, and her mindset, what her mindset was, is she did not want her children to suffer by the fact that she was gone. So she was bringing him with her. That's their theory. In that theory, you have to have a legitimate attempt at suicide. Otherwise, their theory doesn't exist in reality. So, it's not common for a moving target. It's not how you want to go in.
The closing, I'm not just trying to pile on. I mean, I felt it was weak, but it felt kind of like a malingering conversation, semi-drunk as you're sobering up late night at the Perkins when you're 21 after you get out of a movie and somebody's trying to pitch you their version of the movie. But you're also kind of interjecting stuff, so then their opinion kind of keeps moving with it too. And the conversation of what they're originally pitching you, their concept of what happened in the movie, is kind of different by the end of the conversation than what it started. It was just like, what are we watching? And with not a lot of conviction either. where it's just like, I'm kind of going through the motions. I'm going to ask again, we've talked about this a few times already, Bob. It does happen. This is just pure conjecture, but do you suspect that the prosecutors weren't really all in this to win this mentally?
I can't discount it. You know, I mean, like when you kind of look at the rock road that they've taken in terms of getting all the way through this trial, and just with the inconsistencies in their theories and not really having anything lined up in terms of, this is what we believe happened, and this is why we believe it happened. It's been like you said, it's been a moving target. They've been moving the goalposts like the entire time. And for me, you know, I understand. I say it all the time on our show. I'm like, they weren't there. The cops weren't there.
Yeah.
Reddington wasn't there. None of us were there. So everybody just needs to understand that when they're hearing attorneys in a trial speak in a matter-of-fact type sense, it's not a matter-of-fact. They've taken the evidence and they've crafted a theory, and it's nothing more than that. And that goes for both sides.
Sure.
That's not just the prosecutor, it's the defense too. That's what I'm always saying. I mean, prosecutors, by the nature of their job, have to be myopic. They have to be tunnel-visioned. They can't be doing what they're doing. They're trying this case like it's a defense case. We're the ones who have to be objective and try to think of every other possibility of what might have happened here. That's what we do.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because you're trying to get to reasonable doubt. And, you know, I mean, Diaz, the boss, who's the elected DA out here, he's the one who said, we're going with it. And he's like, I'm assuming, said, I want two women on it. And these two gals are the ones who got pulled out of the box, said, you go with it. And they're both experienced.
Yeah,
like, yeah.
It's not their first rodeo. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you can't help but think, maybe their heart's not all the way in it.
They seem to understand it the way. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tony.
What happens in that scenario, Bob? I mean, when you get the, I mean, is it literally a name being pulled out of the box? I mean, and I mean, what you're assigned the case. Can you, what if you are like morally opposed to what you're being said? This is what you're going to go argue. I mean, can you, what do you do in that scenario?
To be honest with you, I can't give you a knowing answer to that because I've never been a prosecutor. You know, I often wonder that same thing. And I've asked prosecutor friends and I'm like, well, what happens if they slide like a pile of shit on your desk? Like, what is your ability to be able to tell your boss, nah, this ain't me. Like, do you have the ability to be able to do that? And the most recent conversation I had, and it was in relation to this case, they were like, not really. You know, it's like my option is to leave, to quit the job.
Yeah, so inside the Bureau, I've actually had a friend of mine that was actually placed on, I won't call in the politics of it, but he was actually called because of my Russian background into an investigation. You can imagine what was taking place, you know, at the higher levels of government the last bunch of years. And we were both talking and said, dude, this is a minefield that you can't even avoid the mines. And this is no good for you. You got to get out. And he says, I can't get out of this because of all the politics involved. And it's a career ender. If you say no, you can't say no to bosses. But what he was able to do is he's actually to show the bias he had because of another area of his life and investigation that was enough to actually get himself recused from it. That was the only thing he was able to do that he actually got the Bureau wouldn't side with him. Yeah. He actually had the Department of Justice side with him that they can't include him in that. So it's a very tricky thing to be able to be recused from it because.
Well, I mean, it's like the very force that is behind like wanting to prosecute something. You're not going to put people on it that you know are going to be the worst for the job that don't want to do this. I mean, that's not going to win it. You got to find the right. But
they didn't.
I don't know how the levers work on that. Yeah,
they didn't really understand what they were prosecuting. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, here's how I look at it. You know, if you're a prosecuting attorney in this case with this fact pattern, with the loss of three beautiful children at the hands of their mother, you know, you've got it. You've got the DA saying, "All right, well, look. This thing is, we've got to charge her with it, you know, like no matter what she says is going on." And so they move forward with it. But if you were, say you're a prosecutor and your brother has gone through psychosis and you're like, well, I actually have personal experience. I know this is real. You know what I mean? And like, I am in a position where you're asking me to essentially go in there and lie about what I know to be true in terms of that particular mental illness. Mm-hmm. And I mean, how do you do that? It's like you said, T, like, you got to go to your boss and be like, look, like my heart's not in it, you know? Yeah. And that's going to be evident when I'm out in front of that jury. They're going to sense it at some point, you know? It's like, I don't know that this is a fake it till you make it type situation of the length of the trial. You know, it's not like it's a 2-day trial. You can go in there.
Yeah,
you know, the jury's going to barely get to know you. You're in there for 5 weeks. They know you. You know, I mean, you get to know the the attorneys during that lengthy type of trial. Yeah,
day in, day
and
out.
You know, it's like, I don't know that you'll be able to kind of sell that if you're really not all the way in with what you're trying to sell them, you know?
Yeah. Like
Reddington, you could see he's all in, right?
Yeah.
Like he's, you could tell he believes what he's saying. He's,
when he also did the deep dive to figure out what it all meant too, you know, he for someone he said it to so many times, both outside of court and in court, you know, he didn't really know much about all this stuff until he did this. And you could see the depth of field he had, the expertise he had as he's doing his discussions ad hoc, off the cuff sometimes. I know everything gets rehearsed and everything, but when you compare the appearance of depth of field of what they were talking about to the prosecution side, it really looked like apples and oranges, especially because I posted it on in the comment section and see if I'm right on this from your take, Bob. You know, because people keep saying she's a monster, just means she's locked away, that monster comment. And yeah. If you think deeply about it, I don't want to negate of what happened was monstrous. Yeah. I think the argument here, which is, all right, so either Lindsay's a monster or something inside her became a monster because of the psychotic break or not, you know, not criminally responsible, because there's a monster somewhere there. And I think that's where the argument is the defense is saying, It's a psychotic break or something else, because it doesn't have to be psychotic break for not guilty by being mentally.
Lack of yeah.
Right,
lack
that one. Yeah. But I think that's the argument. And it seemed like the two prosecutors didn't quite understand what everyone else was saying on the other side. It's like totally dismissive of it. It's
did
like,
they? That I mean, or is there, was there no lane for them to go in to understand it? Because it just, if they start understanding it, then their whole case goes up. Before we go to the defense, Bob, what do you think, what was the most impactful message or moment that the prosecution had in this case, if they had any? What stood to you? Bob, your mic's out again. No, I can't hear Bob. Let's there we go.
Damn it. All right. Sorry.
There we go. Okay. Yeah. We're doing sign language.
That was the most insightful thing right there, Bob. Yeah. You missed it.
Ask again real quick, T. I missed it. I was reading comments that Todd was throwing up, or one of you two guys throwing
okay,
up.
Okay. Yeah. Todd was throwing them up. So the prosecution, if you were to look back at this best moment that they had, what landed the strongest for them at the end of the day?
Good question.
I think that ultimately, probably the strongest moment for them is not necessarily based in evidence. I think their strongest moment has been that they have continually hammered the jury over the head with emotion about these children. I mean, you see it like you were asking that question and I was reading the chat that you put up and it's like, I'm not going to try to tell people how to feel. You know what I mean? Like people are feeling deeply that, you know, oh, the children are getting forgotten in this. And they're not by anybody that's following the case, not by anybody that's covering this case, not by anybody that knows anything about this case. No one's forgetting about the kids. But when you move into the legal process, the focus then shifts from what happened to the beautiful babies to why and can the mother be held criminally responsible? That's the entire focus.
Right.
And I just don't think that they did prove that the psychosis, which is their burden entirely, wasn't happening. Because I saw it in that comment, the first one that Todd put up, this misconception that the prosecutors keep putting out there that you cannot plan while you're in a state of psychosis is just patently wrong.
Well, yeah, their own experts were contradicting their own line of thinking. I mean, did they do more harm than good by putting the amount of experts that they put up there? Because one doesn't agree with the other, and then one has the, I mean, it's like they didn't check their notes before they said, yes, please come to the stand.
Forget about Mac. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Like Mac. Yeah. Just move him aside.
Oh, my God. What a disaster.
Oh, that was a disaster.
More than embarrassment.
Oh, man.
Watching people end their careers during this is actually pretty interesting to me.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. It's not the first time we've seen it. And
my God.
Right, he got pulled down off of the websites for both Nemours and Philadelphia Children's. Yeah. Like he's not, if you Google him.
The total lack of self-awareness that some of these people had while they're testifying, they thought they weren't being watched or really regarded by anyone. They could just call it in, you know, because I'm so, yeah. I mean, he had the impression of, look, I'm so important. You're just going to listen to me because I say it. Look at me. And you're like, dude, you are way off.
Like you said, T, did they call too many? Because frankly, you know, you've got Heilbrunn saying, yeah, you know, Resnick's kind of the man, you know, who was the defense's expert in terms of the criminal responsibility side of it. And he is the man. I mean, the guy's worked on every major case that you can think of from all types. You know, it was Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, Casey Anthony, everything and everything in between, school shootings, everything. Yeah. So, I mean, the guy, and he's done more filicide cases than anybody on the planet.
Yeah.
No, so you've got to give him weight in terms of what his opinion is. And then, you know, the problem for the Commonwealth witnesses is that they had zero experience aside from 25 years ago, 30 years ago during his residency when he dealt with a pregnant woman.
Yeah.
Whatever he did.
I know. I was so like, again, like, why are they? I mean, why call half of these people at all is what I was wondering. It's like, just because, again, can't get anybody. Yeah. So
just answer the question. That's exactly it. I mean, you have to believe the Commonwealth was searching high and low. Number one, for a female expert who actually has some knowledge about postpartum depression. But I mean, maybe their thing is they're deniers that that's a real thing. As we all know at this point, it's not a standalone disorder in the DSM.
Yeah.
You know, postpartum depression, it does not exist in there. It's not in their Bible. And, you know, they may be of the mindset, look, we're not going to give that argument any oxygen. We're going to pretend like it doesn't exist, which is basically what they did.
Yeah, and it's another layer that you have to get the jury to understand that, yes, here's how the DSM handles it, but in Europe, you know, it's basically the, you know, the metric system versus, you know, standard. You know, it's like, it is far more recognized over here. Just because we're on a different continent doesn't mean it doesn't exist. But, I mean, what, we live in a country where state by state, certain, you know, things are recognized as existing or not in the mental health world.
100%. So,
yeah, I want to address really quick the incredibly stupid, heartless comment that this person made on our feed about the three of us having lost, you know, losing our kids and standing by, you know, and watching it happen for 20 minutes. Yeah, that's the one. What a great, great comment you just made there. Because, you know, if you had actually listened to the testimony of everyone in the her family, his family that did lose the kids, who are they standing with? And you have no idea, each of us having kids, what we go through with our own kids. So why don't you take your mouth, close it, open your ears, and learn at least two more things today? That is the most insensitive bullshit thing I've actually seen on this show.
Get a Robin.
Boom. Drop the mic.
I'm in complete.
I stand with the family who did lose the kids. How about that one?
Yep.
That's okay. Well, I mean, she's going to go back she's going to go feed a cat.
Sorry, I'm done.
No, who was the most compelling witness to you in terms of what that person had to have been thinking and what that person lost walking into that courtroom? Who do you guys think was the most compelling witness for the defense? And I know we haven't gotten to that yet, but like,
we'll go into it now. But yeah,
I got a lot of equals. Emotionally pragmatically? I got emotionally and pragmatically. Yeah. I have two on that one.
Let's get your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube for the prosecution on how all of that landed.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.